SMA News Today, daily digital coverage of spinal muscular atrophy.
Welcome to the SMA News Today podcast, episode 12. I'm your host, Kevin Schaefer. Joining me today is Kristen Walters. Kristen is an individual with SMA type 2 from Austin, Texas. Kristen, thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks, Kevin. Thanks for having me.
Oh, absolutely. So for our listeners out there, Kristen and I met at the Cure SMA conference in Dallas, Texas recently. So a little closer to home for you, a little farther away from me, but that was a lot of fun. So we'll definitely be talking about that today on the show, as well as Kristen's story and background, and then her Spinraza treatments and her daily life. So without further ado, so Kristen, to start off, if we could just talk a little bit about your background, and in particular, your diagnosis and how what growing up with SMA was like for you. Just to start off, can you talk about when you were diagnosed and sort of what that initial experience was like? And then we'll talk kind of about growing up with SMA.
Sure. When I was about 6 months old, I wasn't pulling into a sitting position and all of that. And of course, my parents were, like most parents would be, worried. At 18 months, I was diagnosed with SMA. They didn't know, and to this day, it's still kind of a question of whether it was type 1 or type 2, but it's pretty obvious, I guess, now that it's type 2. And like most type 2s, I think, that get diagnosed at a young age, I was told, oh, she's not going to live to be 2. Then, oh, she's not going to live to be 10. And 24 years later, I'm sitting here with you. So I think it's pretty typical to hear that, though, for a lot of type 2s.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think especially back then, doctors would give that kind of diagnosis because it was long before, treatments like Spinraza were available. You hear that a lot. I mean, about, they give that initial life expectancy and it almost never turns out accurate. So, yeah, for sure. Okay, so from then on, first of all, are you an only child or do you have siblings?
I have two older brothers. They're identical twins.
Okay.
And they don't have the disease. They're awesome. I love them. They've done so much for me.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. No, I'm actually the youngest of three with, both my siblings are able-bodied as well. I was going to ask about that, as the youngest in your family and the first one with SMA, what was it like growing up, both on family level, personal level, all these things? Because I know every SMA individual is different, but what was your experience like kind of growing up with it, doing family life, social life, all that?
Well, honestly, as a kid, I had a wonderful life. Like, I was a very happy kid. I have a fantastic family that I would do anything for, and they love me dearly. They're an amazing support system. I never felt like I was missing anything when I was a kid. I always felt like I was right there with the rest of the kids in my class in elementary school. It was amazing to see how well other kids responded to me, and I was pretty happy. Like most people, that, changes a little bit, and when you start to become a teenager, and hormones and stuff. And I ended up developing panic disorder and severe depression, and I think that's another pretty typical thing with people with diseases like this, is depression. And it's hard not to be depressed when you realize you don't get to do all the things and have all the opportunities everybody else does. And I know the feeling of like thinking that you're not going to live as long of a life or things like that can also be very detrimental to having a good positive mindset. I struggled a little bit in high school. Not that that's an unusual thing for anybody, high school, they call it high school hell for a reason. but I dealt with this anxiety and I dealt with this depression, and I honestly, I would have people who would see me in school and then see me out of school, and I was a completely different person. I was shy. I didn't want to talk to anybody. I always felt like I was screwing up. And the amazing thing is, I actually, when I was like 8, I was the Goodwill Ambassador for Muscular Dystrophy Association for the state of Nevada. And I did public speaking. I was, everybody always said, oh, what a sweet girl. And then you see me in, you know, high school and I'm not talking to anybody. I didn't know how to approach people. I didn't have a lot of friends. It's crazy how different the two things are, you know?
Right. Oh, I mean, and I think that is a common experience for really just anyone, not just with SMA, but to kind of go from that transition. But yeah, you're absolutely right, especially with, you know, when you do have a severe neuromuscular condition, it does have an effect on your mental health as well, for sure. But going off on that, I'm curious, were you able to find, like, any outlets in the midst of all that, like either extracurriculars or anything, like either in high school or later? Like, was there anything that, any passions you kind of found?
Well, I never really participated in a whole lot of extracurriculars in high school. Middle school, I was in theater a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But it, I feel like those kind of things are kind of hard to continue with because it's, there's not an easy way to make a wheelchair blend in with the production. And as much as I know they would never actually say that, it really had an impact on my interest in theater and choir and things like that. But I've always been an extremely creative person. And I'm fascinated with artists and music. And I love drawing and being creative and crafting. I taught myself how to sew. I taught myself how to knit. I've been drawing since I was little and really enjoy it. So I guess that's been the most, it's probably been the biggest thing that I've been able to kind of rely on to get out of my own head.
Sure, sure. I think, you know, I mean, I can relate because, I mean, I've always been very much into arts and creativity, so it's those kind of things definitely help when you're kind of stuck in that bubble, for sure. But it's funny you say that about theater, though, because so I did a lot of theater growing up, and while there are challenges with that, my favorite role still was sophomore year in high school. I was the voice of the Cyclops in the Odyssey, so that was like the way they were able to like totally incorporate me and everything. So that was awesome. A lot of fun, but yeah. Just an encouragement. If you ever want to get back into it, it is possible. But that's cool. So, okay. So I, and then going from there, so did you go to college at all, or have you just kind of like, done more like online stuff or what?
I did start, I took a year off, and in that year I got the opportunity, I went through a WISH program, like, when I was a teenager, and I already turned 18, but they had approved me before I turned 18, and I got a chance to go to France and see where my grandmother was born, which is a little town in eastern France, and it was incredible, and I'm so glad I took that year off, because there's no way I would have been able to go to school and take that big of a trip and not, you know, have it affect my grades. So I went back to school the next year and I struggled a little bit with, you know, between the depression and anxiety and just trying to get back into school and really figuring out what I wanted to see. I started with graphic design and I wasn't super happy with it. And so over the years, I tried different classes. I didn't make it through all of them. And, that kind of gets to when I got sick, I guess.
That's it. Well, let's talk about that in just a sec. But first, I did not know about the France trip. So tell me a little more about that. You said it was through the Make-A-Wish Foundation that it was made possible?
It was not Make-A-Wish. It was another program.
Okay.
I can't of the name at the moment, though.
I gotcha. But it was like kind of a similar, kind of like a wish-granting organization?
Yes.
Okay, exactly. Very cool. So, okay, so you stay, how long did you stay there?
10 days.
Okay, that's awesome. So, like, yeah, and mm-hmm. was that the your first time out of the country?
It was incredible. I remember, you know, it was, you know, it's like we had to go to Atlanta, and then it's like 3-hour trip to Atlanta mm-hmm. on plane, and then like 12 hours to get to France. But it was so worth it. I remember our first night there, we were all exhausted.
Sure.
My mom and my brother came with me, and originally my brother was supposed to drive, but he didn't know how to drive stick. So my mom had to drive because all the cars there are stick shifts.
Ah, gotcha.
And we ended up, we started in Paris, and we drove the first day through the country to the a little town in Lorraine, and it's called Nancy, and it's adorable. One day I want to go back, and I want to stay there for longer. It was so cool.
What was it like? I mean, I know there are obvious challenges with the flying there, but you made it there. What was it like in terms of accessibility and navigating once you were there?
So I was actually pleasantly surprised. A lot of the more updated places were pretty accessible. I don't remember a whole lot that wasn't. I remember not wanting to go into not wanting to go into Notre Dame because I didn't have a chance to turn around once I got in, and it's like a few hours of going through it.
Okay.
And it was like, I don't know how I feel about being stuck in there for that long. But things like that, you know, weren't that big a deal. We got to do a lot. I was surprised at like the amount of accessibility. Of course, the cobblestone road is brutal on my neck. But, and the car was pretty tiny. I mean, I had like, there was like a shelving unit, like, right, you know, they're kind of like shelves or little container areas that are on the roof of the car, like where people in the backseat can reach for them.
Okay. Yeah.
Sometimes there was one right in front of my eyes. I mean, I felt like I was going to crash into it so many times, but I didn't, which is good. Of course.
Okay.
And I remember, we went to the Louvre, and that's extremely accessible. And I was just in awe of all the artwork and all of the history. But they actually let me go closer to the Mona Lisa than anybody else got to go, so I could get a good look at it. And that was pretty incredible.
That's awesome. That's really good to hear that it was. I mean, because, like, I mean, I know, you know, it varies depending on where you are in Europe, but I've heard that the challenges, like from other people that may have gone, either, you know, to London or wherever, that's the hardest thing is kind of now, like you said, the cobblestone, and also like just a lot of restaurants and stuff have like a big step leading into them or whatever. Like, was that it? Like, were you able to get into most restaurants and stuff?
I think that usually the steps that I saw were manageable with, like, my brother was, I was 18, my brother was, like, 25 at the time. And, you know, pretty capable, but if I needed a little bit of a push, he gave me a push.
Okay.
But for the most part, I don't remember things being incredibly hard to get to.
Did you bring a manual chair, too, or just your power chair?
Nope, just my power chair.
Okay, that's impressive. That's cool. That's good to hear.
I will tell you that the plane, when we got to France, they said that this was the biggest wheelchair they'd ever seen on the plane.
Really?
And they put it aside, and I was like, oh, that's awful.
Wow. That's surprising, because, I mean, I know, obviously, like, they're not going to see a ton of power chairs, because it's harder to transport them that far, but still, like, mm-hmm. I mean... I wouldn't think your chair is that much bigger than any other power chair. That's weird, but
right.
Yeah, interesting. Well, Well, that's cool. I know. I'm glad that was a great experience. And so, and that definitely helped for, you know, leading into after that. But yeah, okay. So let's get back to, all right. So you went to school for a little bit after that. And then you said you had a major illness in when, yeah, I mean, talk about this, like when this happened and, you know, how long that went on for.
Sure. I got sick, I want to say February 2015.
Okay.
They always said I present like a PED patient. I don't know if you know what that means, but when they say like, I'll be like fine 1 minute and it won't even seem like I'm sick, and then I'll crash. And I had one of those moments where I went to the doctor. I didn't want to be at the doctor. I didn't want to be at the hospital. I thought, oh, I'm fine. And, you know, I was coughing. It wasn't that big of a deal, though. And they're like, okay, you need to go to the hospital. We're going to check you in to the hospital, and you'll stay there. You'll do some breathing treatments. We'll get you some meds. And the next morning, they were getting ready to release me when I started coughing so bad that I had breathing treatment. 10 minutes later, I thought I needed another one. Eventually, and anybody who goes to the hospital knows you can never get anybody in your room during shift change. It was shift change. I had 10 people in my room because wow. I was coughing so hard I couldn't breathe.
Wow. Ugh.
And honestly, I don't remember much after that. I was put into a medicated coma, so it got better.
Wow.
And it was a few weeks. It was very traumatic. I had trached in. I was really lucky because I got taken out and I didn't have to keep it in. And I know that's not a usual thing that happens.
Yeah. Did they ever diagnose it? Like, was it really serious pneumonia or?
Yeah.
Okay.
It was pneumonia.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh gosh.
And that was terrifying. And I got so weak being in bed that long. You know, I mentally, it did a lot of damage. It made things really tough with my family. They were scared out of their minds. I was lucky. I had an incredible doctor. Incredible. He took care of my family. He took care of me. And I'd like to say that was, like, the end of, like, difficult times. But I had some really crappy stuff happen after that, too. After I finally started getting better, I was in a small car accident. I ended up breaking my feet. That really sucked.
Wow.
And then a year later, I ended up back in the ICU with another pneumonia. It wasn't as bad, but it was still another pneumonia. I was still in the ICU. Yeah, so I've had a tough few years, and I'm trying to, you know, get back on my feet from it.
I mean, yeah, I can't imagine going through all that. I mean, I've had my fair share of pneumonia before, but, like, I never had to go through a coma or anything like that. And that was, and for you, that was, like, back-to-back and all that. So, that's,
yeah.
I mean, the fact that you're still, you know, you've overcome all that, I mean, yeah, I would need a break after all that, too. For sure. But, wow, that's, so, like, wait, so, all right, so that was in 2015, and then you said the car accident wasn't that long after that, but
it was about a year, and then a year after the car accident, I was back in the hospital.
Dang, again. Good gosh.
Yeah.
It's like a trilogy, like once a year, like have something crazy happen, but.
Yeah, I'm nothing, I think it's like, you know that saying, bad things happen in threes? I'm really hoping that's true, and that's just over
with. And then it's over, yeah, for sure. Well, maybe, have you had anything happen this year?
No, actually, only thing that happened this year, substantial, is I started my Spinraza, and that's been good, so there's a big difference.
That's a good, yeah, no, that's great, and that's a good transition point here, because, yeah, no, I don't want to make you relive, like, all the traumas of the past few years where it's on this podcast, so, no, that's a much brighter note to get on, so. Let's talk about that. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you had your first loading dose earlier this year?
January 11th.
Okay, so you're done with your loading doses, and then I guess have you had a maintenance one yet? I'm trying to do the math here.
Next week, actually.
Oh, next week. Okay, that's awesome. So probably by the time this podcast will go up, you'll have either had it or you're going into it. But Let's talk about that. So, first off, like, what was the process like of getting, I mean, because, you know, Spinraza was approved late 2016, you just started earlier this year. What was the process like getting, you know, past insurance approvals and then starting the injections? If you want to just talk about that whole journey.
Sure. Okay. I was really, really, really depressed after all of that 3 years of
hell. Yeah, understandably so. Yeah.
Understandably. And I, as much as I was interested in Spinraza when I first heard about it, I was excited, and everybody else, all my family members, and my normal support system were like, we don't know. Like, we don't want you getting too excited if this doesn't mean anything. And
sure.
It's understandable. They wanted to protect me. But I kind of put it aside. I'm like, I want to wait till other people go through it and then think about it. And that's what I did. I waited maybe a year and a half before I started the process. But I did all of my research. I researched it top to bottom. I asked questions. I tried to pre-plan for any problems I'd have. I went through insurance, what other people had gone through with my insurance, which is Medicare, which sucks. But
most insurance companies do. But
yeah. I was like, okay, what are the problems other people are having? How do I get around them? And I spent a lot of time looking up it up and knowing as much about it as I possibly could. And I learned a lot. I learned a lot, and I just got more excited because I was seeing, you know, all the videos of, like, little kids who might not even be alive if they didn't have Spinraza. And now they're walking, they're living very functioning lives. And that's just incredible to me. Incredible.
For sure. I mean, especially when you go to conferences and you see the impact it's having on, you know, obviously little kids, but also adults like us. It's been really remarkable. Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. So, and I totally understand that as far as, you know, waiting and seeing. I mean, especially after what you went through. But even me, I'm like, I've been pretty healthy the past few years, aside from, I did have pneumonia earlier this year, but it wasn't nearly like what you went through. But even me, as another adult with SMA, I had major anxieties as well about the whole process and, you know, if and what the side effects would be, all these things. So now after you did all that research and you did go through the process, what was the first injection like for you?
Well, first I should add that I was really surprised at how quickly the process took for me, because I expected a lot longer, because that's what other people had been through.
Sure.
I went to my doctor's appointment in, I think, November, and I started my first injection in January, which was crazy to me.
Really is, yeah, because it took me and most other adults, like, yeah, months to get insurance approval, but so that's really good. I'm glad you were able to avoid that.
Yeah. I think the one thing I don't remember about the first injection is the anxiety, and I think everybody has that anxiety.
Yeah.
But the anxiety is the worst part. I mean, it's not that bad once you get through it, and then you're like, why was I torturing myself with this?
I can relate to that exactly. I mean, I had those same anxieties and those same concerns about what would happen, and then went through it and actually went really okay. So, but do you, okay, so what kind of method do you use for your injections? Because I do the cervical injections because they weren't able to do a spinal tap because of my spinal fusion. Which method do you use for yours?
I also have this, my spine fused. They tried to go in through the radiology thing. I can't think of what it's called.
I know what you're talking about, too, but yeah. I probably should know, but, like, I'm kind of bad with the terminology as well. So.
Well, I'm not using it, so it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah.
Then they tried a CT scan with, because I have the bone grafts.
Right.
And they tried a CT scan with through the neural foramen.
Yes.
And that's what I use now.
Okay, very cool. Gotcha. Do they sedate you for that, or is it just, like, are you awake and everything during the procedure?
No, they haven't sedated me.
Okay.
I will say that I've been, I get them to put an IV in, just in case, because when they do the blood work, because every single time they've gone in there, they've hit a nerve, and it's so painful.
Yeah, I can, that's...
So they'll give me some medicine to kind of, like, calm me down for the next hour, so I'm not just laying there in pain, and it's helpful, but I don't get sedated beforehand. It's pretty similar to any other, like, I get steroid injections sometimes in my arms occasionally, or my hip. I have bad arm and hip, and I think it's super similar to that, and they used to not be able to get an IV on me for those. So even before they started not sedating people for those, they weren't sedating me because they just couldn't get an IV on me. So
right.
I'm pretty used to the process.
Okay, you know? That's really good, yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, that was for me. Once you get through especially the first loading doses, yeah, and even just the first one or two injections, it's a lot smoother from there on. But okay, so now that you've gone through the loading doses, have you noticed any changes, either minor or really significant for you since starting the whole process?
I don't know. So the thing about it for me is that I have other people saying, oh, I see this and I see that. And while I could see some of it, like my mom says, my energy is better. And I can agree with that.
Uh-huh.
And I'm sitting a little straighter, my neck's a little stronger, things like that. I feel like a lot of times it's my parents saying, oh, she's on the medicine, so things must be better. So they're kind of just putting something, an image in their head that they're expecting. And I don't know how accurate it is. I don't know if there's actually things that are, you know, getting better as much as they say they are, or if it's their wishful thinking, you know?
I totally understand. I think it's very common for, like, anyone who's on Spinraza, adult or kid, like, people around you are going to have expectations, obviously, that,
yeah.
And it's very natural. Like, they want to see, you know, really big improvements. When, especially for adults like us, it's the little things that really make the biggest impact. So, like you said, you know,
right,
the energy levels, like, just being able to sit up straighter a little bit, that's huge for us. So, and those are, like, really, you know, and I pretty much every adult I've talked to going in, like, our only hope is to stop the progression, and anything else is a bonus. So I think that's very common for other people to have those kind of expectations. But it really varies on a person-to-person basis, kind of what an effect it'll have. And that's okay, you know? I mean, but that's good, though. Like, I mean, I was just curious kind of see what... have you done an evaluation with either your neurologist or OT or anyone since starting?
They didn't ask... Okay. So they didn't ask for a physical therapy or occupational therapy, like, evaluation for insurance for me.
Okay.
And I'm not really sure why, but I started going to a PT shortly after starting. And she says she's noticed a little bit of a difference, but there hasn't been a real evaluation, I don't think.
That's just interesting, because it usually is a stipulation for insurance companies to want to have some kind of way to measure the effect it's had, so
right,
they'll keep doing it. So that's interesting. I wouldn't expect they will eventually, I was just curious if you've done that yet. Do you do any kind of PT on the side, like, in general, or anything to help with, to coincide with your treatments?
Well, interestingly enough, I've done PT and OT across my life, like, over my life, you know, in
sure,
school a lot, I did that kind of stuff. I think that's pretty normal for most people, but I stopped when I got older because I had trouble finding the correct PT, and one that was close enough, and one that wasn't going to treat me like a child, which was you know, a not never ending, like, that happens so much.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I stopped seeing physical therapists for a while, but I found one I really liked because I had to get an evaluation done for a new chair, and I decided I wanted, if I was going to do, you know, the Spinraza, I needed to get in physical therapy, and I found her, and I really liked her. But then I went to a Biogen meeting not that long ago, and they had one in Austin, and they had one for kids and one for adults. And the one for kids was the day after my first injection, or the day after my first injection. And I went in, and I met some people, but there wasn't a lot of people there. I went to the adult one. There were all these people I knew, and it was crazy. I didn't know any of them would be there. But I found out that apparently it's not recommended for people with SMA to do physical therapy, and that was kind of a shock to me. I did not know that, so.
I don't know. You hear different perspectives on that, because, like...
Yeah.
Because, like, I've been doing water therapy for a few years, so even before I started Spinraza, and I love it. Like, I mean, I hate on-land PT.
Yeah.
It, like, that never... That. Yeah. Water therapy has been tremendous for me. Whether I was on Spinraza or not, I would still be doing that. But it's especially helped with Spinraza. But I don't know. You hear that too. Like, it's, I think the difference is that, like, it used to be not that effective because it's like there weren't any drugs that were going to help you build your muscles anyway. So it's like, what's the point? But I think now it is I think that attitude and mentality is changing because it's like, I mean, just speaking from personal experience, I think water therapy has helped even more than I'm on Spinraza now because it coincides with it and helps me, you know, exercise those muscles that are starting to kind of wake up, you know?
Yeah.
But you're absolutely right, too, in that it's important to find one that is going to treat you, as you said, like an adult and not like a kid because I think that's that's a point I brought up at a panel at the SMA conference recently was, you know, the best doctors I've had are the ones who talk to me directly and not my parents. Because there's nothing that, oh my gosh, there's nothing that gets on my nerves more like that than when you're sitting in the room and, you know, obviously my mom is there or my dad is there with me to drive me, but like still talk to me. I'm the patient, you know?
I know. And it's so hard because like, I don't really understand it. I don't understand if it's just a, you know, generally having a smaller stature. Like, I already look, even if I didn't have SMA, I look young for my age. Even somebody at the conference that I'd met before, I saw them, and they came over, and they were, like, asking somebody next to me if they wanted to drink, and then they went to ask me, and they said, oh, you're not old enough to drink, and I'm like, yes, I am. He's like, no, you're 17, and I'm like, I'm 24.
It's, that's a stereotype I'll never, like, why is it, yeah, because I come from a short family, too, so it's like, hey, the height really does not matter, like, what you're,
right,
when they do that.
And, like, you have, like, facial hair and stuff, don't you? Like,
yeah. I know, it's, no.
They generally don't have that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Know?
My sister's had that experience, too, of, like, just being totally mistaken for younger, and yeah. Oh.
Yeah.
It gets annoying, for sure. But yeah, but that's, no, it's a really good point though about finding the right PT and, right doctor too. Someone who will treat you like an adult and talk to you directly. So that's huge.
Right.
Well, and on that note, since we brought up the conference, so you and I were both at the CareSMA conference in Dallas recently. Could you talk about that experience, like this year specifically and kind of like what it was like, any panels you went to that stuck out or is anything you want to say about that conference?
Sure. It was my first conference and I had a great time. I totally intend to save up money and go next year. I think it was incredible. You know, I live in Austin and it was in Dallas and I actually go to get my injections in Dallas. So it wasn't that far of a drive and it was a great experience. I think I learned a lot of information. from the panel. I went to, I went through the driving one. I went to the independent living one. I went to the traveling one. I went to a yoga one. That one was kind of whack, to be honest.
I haven't been to that one, but I've heard about it. Yeah.
It was really ridiculous, but I think the biggest thing, though, was meeting other people, like meeting you and meeting some of the other people in that kind of, like, group, the Fellowship of the Wheels, as you call it.
That was the term I coined, because it was too perfect not to say, because we were, like, it was like 20 of us all outside in this circle. It looks so Lord of the Rings. I was like, I'm calling this right now. That's our band name.
Yeah, we looked like a gang. We looked like we were about to beat up all the tourists that walked by.
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah, it was cool.
Don't mess with us.
Right. You're right, though. It was like, I mean, it's hard to put into words kind of the connection you have when a bunch of adults with SMA or kids with SMA, parents, whatever, you know, when you're there in the same environment and you get to actually, like, just talk with each other and everyone gets it, whereas, like, it's harder to have that kind of, the same kind of community in your everyday life. It's just like you're with all these people who go through the same things and understand the issues you go through.
Somebody on the Cure SMA, like, Facebook page was saying, I wish we could all, like, find a neighborhood and live next to each other and all the kids could go to school together and we could all work together. And, like, you're going to get sick of these people quick, but yeah, it's a nice idea.
It's good. Well, and it's just good to, like, even if we're not, like, living each other next to each other, like, to have that kind of community throughout the year, both online or, you know, in person when you can, and then at the conferences. So it's for sure.
I never met so many people that, like, I so easily related to, because it's like, even with other diseases or other disabilities, even, like, going to MDA camp when I was younger, it was different because, you know, not everybody was dealing with the exact same issues.
Yep.
But here it's like, oh, yeah, does this happen? Does this happen to you? And it's so easy to just know and be like, well, I want to do this. Have you ever done that? What's your suggestions? I was telling one of the girls I was talking to, she was like, we're talking about hobbies and stuff, and I made a comment that I sewed, and I was giving her some tips on how I sew, because you have to use the foot pedal for the sewing machine, so I use my elbow to push it, and, like, learning things like that, like, getting to talk to other people and be like, how do you do this? I want to do this, and then be able to say, oh, you just have to do it this way, is a great tool to have.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I had that similar experience, too, even with, I mean, regardless of, like, age and stuff there, just all the adult, because we had, in that adult group, we had people like us in our 20s, some were in their 50s, others in their 40s, and, like, we were all just able to relate, share different issues, and bringing up, like, little things, and then things like traveling, you know, things like what equipment we use, all these things that just, like you said, you have that instant connection that's just, it's hard to find anywhere else, for sure. But yeah, I'm glad you were able to make it out this year, for sure. And I guess on that note, too, before we wrap up, so obviously you've been through a lot in the last few years, and I understand the need to just kind of take it easy after going through all that hell, but what's kind of your daily life like now, like a typical day of the week for you? You know, I know you mentioned some of your hobbies, and what kind of things do you do to kind of keep yourself occupied right now?
It kind of changes every day. I'm not going to lie. I get lazy and I just, sometimes I have days where I just want to play video games and sometimes I do that. I sleep in a lot because I don't have to get up and it sounds simple, but then there are days where I have like 3 doctor's appointments and paperwork and insurance decides to be stupid and cause trouble because that just happens all the time for me. It's just me, my luck.
And now insurance likes to mess with everyone, so you're not alone there.
Yeah, not fun.
Yeah, no, well, do you have any caregivers or is it just your family?
I do. Unfortunately, one of them's daughter got injured a few months ago, big weekday person, and so she had to quit. And it's unfortunate. I really liked her, but I'm in the process, which is excruciating, of finding somebody new.
Oh, yeah.
I think that's pretty understandable. It's just, I've been through people, and it's like, I'll be like, oh, you want the job? And they'll be like, sure. And they'll come and say, okay, we're going to fill out paperwork tomorrow. And then they'll never show up, or they won't even call. Some people will call, but they'll be like, I changed my mind. This is happening. And I get, you know, people have emergencies and stuff. It's really hard to not take it personal after a while when people are always canceling and saying, oh, I changed my mind. It's difficult.
Oh, I've been there for sure. I mean, fortunately, I've had, you know, the same caregiver for a few years, but as far as, like, finding other people for other days that he can't be there, people don't realize just the logistical nightmare it is to find the right agency, the right people. And like you said, there are people who say that they want to work with you and then they never show up or call or anything. And then you're back to square one. So it's not an easy process for any of us. It's the best advice I can give to people is to just, you know, like ask the right questions when you're interviewing, try to get an idea of whether they're going to be a trustworthy person or not in that first interaction. Right. And then, you know, if they don't work out, just got to keep trying. And, it helps to have a good social worker. It helps to have a good agency to work with.
I don't use an agency because I know that through an agency they get paid a little bit less. And
yeah,
I being able to choose the people that I have. But it's hard, and I understand I can only pay, you know, like $10 an hour, and that's awful wage. I know that. But it's still frustrating, and I just wish the people, my main wish is that people will let you know, hey, things aren't working out, this is the reason why, and I might feel a little bit better about myself in the end, because, like I said, it's hard to not take it personal when people cancel all the time.
Yeah, I know what you mean, and, well, that's the thing, like, whether you're going through an agency or you're hiring people yourselves, there are pros and cons to both, but but ultimately, I mean, it's just hard to find people, especially in that, like you said, in that business, it doesn't pay well, whether you're paying out of pocket or you're going through government hours or whatever. It's just not a high paying job, and so it is hard to find good people and hold on to them, but you'll find the right people eventually. It's just, it does take a lot of logistical loopholes and trial and error and all these things, but that's good. You do have that, you know, have the resources as well. So, cool. Well, no, this was a great conversation. I guess before we go, do you, like, since you've been through a lot, especially in the last few years, and then, you know, you're kind of like starting to get it back on your feet now, do you have any advice for other people with SMA or other people with disabilities in general?
Sure. I would say have hope. Hope is something I lost very easily, but I've gained it back. I've gained it back through, honestly, Spinraza's been a big part of that, because I'm hoping that it'll mean that I'm not going to continue to get worse. But I have hope that in the future there will be more scientific research that'll help more diseases, and more people can get the benefit of, like, what Spinraza does for SMA. I have hope that more options for SMA will come out soon. I have hope that, you know, there's going to be, you can still live a good life, even if you're in a chair. And I think a lot of people think that, oh, you can't do all of these things. I always think of it as, you can do these things, you just have to do them differently. That's the big thing. Be creative. MacGyver things, as I call it, you know, where you grab a back scratcher and a piece of string and a piece of tape and you make something out of it to reach something across the floor. Just work with what you have and you'll be surprised at how much you can do in life. Don't let the disability restrict you.
Yeah, that's great advice. And I mean, and I think your life definitely shows that, and there are countless other individuals with SMA who prove that every day for sure. So, yeah, that's great. Well, Kristen, thank you for joining us today. I think this was great and definitely a lot of good topics to discuss here. And I definitely hope too, you won't have any more experiences like the 2015 through 2017 trilogy of madness you went through.
Yeah.
I think you paid your dues for sure. So
yeah.
Very cool. For our listeners out there, for more stories like Kristen's here, be sure to subscribe to the SMA News Today podcast. All episodes are available on Podbean, iTunes, SoundCloud, and right here on our website at www.smanewstoday.com. Be sure to check out our forums page as well for discussions like this, where we talk about all kinds of topics, and those are available for patients with SMA, parents and caregivers, and medical professionals. So be sure to check out those. And yeah, we will be sure to subscribe to SMA News Today for all the latest coverage on spinal muscular atrophy. I'm Kevin Schaefer. We will see you next time.